the bottom of the story, this one little note. One of the notes of get well that was sent her before director Oliver Stone. Presley made a brief appearance in the movie W. I guess I don't qualify as able to pull those dots together. But how do you ignore that when you know how murderous the Russ? Thanks again for joining in this evening. I hope you enjoyed your time with me as much as I enjoyed mine with you. Thanks to everyone who participated in the chat rooms, who listens live, who listens on podcast. Thank you. An update, thanks to the generosity of listeners, we did cross the $1,000 threshold for the month. It is the 27th of October. We've got 4 days to try to get to what it takes to get us through a month. But, way Mark, and thank you so very much to everyone who stands shoulder to shoulder to keep independent, liberal conversation going here at the Horn and available to whomever wants to listen. Thank you. We had a new listener. We heard from a new listener. Says she's been enjoying the show for the last couple of weeks. Lord, she says it's really been doing my heart good. She says, I've already voted for Obama, the only real candidate. So thank you very kindly for tuning in, and let us know your thoughts. To John Fox and Peter Godbold, thanks to Ben Birch, the most overworked, hardest-working man in liberal talk, WhiteRoseSociety.org. To the bravest, hardest-working people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. And always, always, RMR, Gina. It's all for you.
The truth. And now here's Guy James.
Oh, you better believe it. All that's left is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth for you today here on the Guy James Show, as we do every day. Welcome and hello from the beaches of Southwest Florida, Naples, Fort Myers area. Awfully glad to be with you today. I betcha. And I couldn't wait to say that. I say that every chance I get nowadays. I betcha. golly gee, and all that. I can't help it. It's just, I'm just all bubbly since Sarah Palin's entered the race. I just, you know, just puts me in a good mood every time I hear her not. Mm. It's getting to be when I hear the woman, and I'm sorry, here I go. Here I go, just starting off again. Fingernails on a blackboard, all that is much more mellow sounding than her voice. Oh my God, I just can't stand it. I cannot stand it. But anyway, I won't say anything else about Sarah Palin the rest of the show, although I want you to know I have my fingers crossing behind my back. Awfully good to have you with us, and as much of it I can. I shouldn't say it that way. Saturdays after around 4 o'clock is the one time of the week that I get to just relax myself. And I watch college football, and I love college football. And I usually go to sleep Saturday night with the TV still on watching college football. I even watched a game the other night with, James Madison University. I forget who, but I watched my beloved Buckeyes, and that was like watching paint dry this week, although they did win. And, of course, the Michigan Wolverines were beaten by mighty Toledo University. And, of course, I know Bob is happy as when West Virginia Mountaineers won. So that's what I do for enjoyment on Saturday evening, watch college football and all that. And, oh, gosh, I went to the, I made a mistake. I went to the doctor yesterday. And, a little dark spot on my cheek that's been, no, it's not a mole or anything like that. Just, I don't know if it's an H spot or doctor yesterday. Doctor says, yeah, I said, I can take care of that. And I'm going away next week. By the way, I won't because I'm, going to be traveling and, so I thought, well, I want to get that spot taken, and I'm at the doctor yesterday. Why am I telling you this? I'm at the doctor yesterday. Sure, I can take care of that. Let me get this liquid nitrogen out and spray it, and well, yeah, they sprayed that another little spot on me, and now I got these real dark spots on my face. A webcam here, I'd show you, but now I'm concerned. When I go away this week, am I going to look like a leopard here, or... I don't know, and I surely don't know why I'm telling you this. Good to have all of you along with us today. News from Florida, Governor Charlie Crist, our governor who can't decide what he is. Let me clarify that. He can't decide what he wants to be in the middle, or Republican or Democrat. But, you know, when his name was being mentioned for being the VP of John McNasty, well, right in there pitching. And he was right in there pitching for a little while afterwards. And it seemed like Charlie had at all the events in Florida. And actually, he was up until last week. In fact, he was at this one not far from here called Skinhead... And by the way, he made such an ass of himself, overwhelmingly in Lee County, Florida, as a sheriff. That gives you an idea what it's like here. But Charlie was there. But Charlie, along with people, are kind of bailing off the McCain ship night right now, kind of like the rats getting off of a sinking ship, if you know what I mean. And this is a sinking ship. I think we'll all agree on that. It is a sinking ship, and barring some kind of a freak anatomy or whatever, Mr. McCain is going to go down in defeat and shame, I might add. But Mr. McCain had an event here in Florida the other day, and Charlie Crist was going to be there. Originally, he was scheduled to be there, and he didn't go because he had to go to Disney World instead. And I'm not kidding. He went to Disney World instead. Ask him about, Charlie, are you going to be campaigning for Senator McCain now? I will if I have time. That doesn't seem enthusiastic to me, does it to you? I will if I have time. Yeah, along with Bill Kristol, Tommy Thompson, and Romney, and a host of others, they're all jumping off the ship and Palin ticket to go back to being themselves, he says. Hell, they are being themselves, Bill. They're the selves that they've exhibited. Are nasty, mean-spirited, conniving individuals. who absolutely lust for power and misuse it when they get it. McCain proved his untrustworthiness with Charles Keating and years ago, and McPalin has proven it in many different respects. And I'll bet you Sarah didn't really enjoy the welcome that she got by the Philadelphia Flyers fan. Golly, I'll bet she didn't. No. She didn't like that one little bit, I would say. And Sarah also, I don't know what they're thinking, but these people are so unashamed. They're so unabashedly, what's the word I'm looking for? Morally bankrupt. And they are. That takes what should have been a rock to the side of the head the other day on Friday when it came out about this Troopergate thing. As well, you know, I'm really glad that I've been absolved of any wrongdoing or anything legally wrong or any ethics violation. Well, wait a minute. You said you've been absolved of any problem with ethics violation, did it not, Slee, in this report? That you were in inflations. Now, it's not unimpeachable of Alaska. It's not something that they're... But she lied about it. She knew damn well her husband was exerting pressure on the state to try and get rid of this brother-in-law of hers. She knew that, and I don't have a big problem with that. If she really and truly felt the guy was that bad and she wanted to use a little leverage that she has about it, well, politicians do that. And I know they do it. They do it on both sides of the aisle. There's very few of them that don't use a little influence now and then. And although it was wrong, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, my God, that's the worst thing that ever happened in the world that she did that, because it isn't. And I know many politicians have done many things wrong, and you hear me for that in a moment. Another story about that in just a moment. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, God, she tried to get her ex-brother-in-law fired, and what a terrible thing that was. That's nothing. The fact that what's wrong with this is, once again, it's the cover-up. It's the cover-up. I am convinced to this day that if Richard Nixon would have stepped out in front of the American public and said, you know what, some of my underlings got carried away, espionage, got caught, and all this. I'm sorry. I apologize. I am so sorry that this happened. They got carried, and you know, G. Gordon Liddy's a rat, and I now know it. And that, I almost think the Republican, the American people would have said, well, we don't like this, but all right. But no, they got to go ahead and bowl their way through it. You know, McPalin, Sarah Palin. About this, it's obvious she lied through her teeth. Her husband lied through his teeth. Everybody in Alaska knows they lied about it. That's the point. If you're caught, give it up. Just give it up. If you're caught, plead insanity, plead ignorance, plead, you know, now we know that besides just trying to use a little influence, that she cannot be trusted on anything. It's just like, you know, McCain. He said that he'd made a mistake. He'd made a big mistake in the Keating 5. Now he has completely forgotten that he ever said that he was contrite about that. And all now it's something different. But they are jumping off, and rats are jumping off. And the campaign has been extremely ugly. And getting uglier every day. Kane has tried to put things right. I don't know if he's really so much tried to put things right. It's just the fact that he wanted to take away a little of the sting tone campaign, because the public has gotten wise to his ads. They have gotten wise to the fact that he sent this from Alaska, this political, I don't know what to call her. I don't know what to call the woman. A good word for it. She conniving. She knows how to play the political game in spades. She knows how to stand up there and lie through her teeth and smile and nod and be so nice and all that. And on the other hand, on some things, she's just clueless. So I can't think of any words to really describe her. I found a little audio cut here. John Cleese. You remember John Cleese, the actor on Monty Python and all. I'll let him explain it.
What do you think about Sarah Palin?
I used to think Michael Palin was the funniest Palin. It's me, though. It's how people watching her on television, can they not see that she's basically learned certain... Listen, very well. She's got a very good memory. Yeah. But it's like a nice-looking parrot. Because the parrot speaks beautifully and kind of says every now and again, but doesn't really have any understanding it is producing, even though it's producing them very accurately. And she's training sessions with Cheney's pals, and she's learned these speeches, and so many people are taken in by it. And the truth is, Palin is no way good enough. And if you lined up from Europe, left-wing, right-wingers, you wouldn't find 10%. You probably wouldn't find 5% who think she's good enough to run the United States. And she's running as the year-old cancer survivor. I mean, Monty Python could have written this. And I'm sorry, Michael Palin, to say you're not the funniest or not.
John Cleese, I love the guy. I always did. I always thought he was tremendously funny. Just thing that I think he ever did. I find him absolutely humorous. But he kind of sums it up for me on Sarah Palin, so try not too much to talk about it anymore today. But you all know that, of course, John McCain has said now that he's got us right where he wants us, right? Yeah, he's got us right where he wants us. And, of course, they've got these ugly mobs now at a lot of their campaign stops. Ugly mobs. And that's exactly what they are. And I think the last time we were together, I think I played a little bit of ugly mob. But where do I have this here? Maybe I don't have it. I thought I did. It's very upsetting, some of the things these people in these lines. Here we go. Some more McCain. And that takes in just about everybody waiting in line to see Sarah Palin or John McCain. It is amazing to watch independent or biased, it doesn't matter, reporters go down those lines and ask them. They're not singling people out, mind you. They're just going down the line and indiscriminately picking people out and saying, what do you think? And here's some...
And one thing we don't need is another lawyer in Washington, and that's Barack Obama. He's a lawyer.
Because that guy gets elected, he hangs around with terrorists.
Who's the terrorist?
Obama.
Obama's a Muslim. He's a terrorist himself.
You really believe that, sir? You really believe that? You believe in us?
I believe he supports terrorism.
Here it is! Vote it!
You think they should die, sir? You think they should die?
Dies, don't they?
And then you kill babies. 50 million babies killed from abortion. He can't protect the most innocent.
Hillary voted to have to pay for their own rape kit. My friends shouldn't have to pay for their own rape kit. How do we feel about that? She should die.
Rape kit.
So is Senator Obama an American too?
I don't know what he is.
Sickos.
What's your concern about Acorn, sir?
I think that Acorn is the sleaziest, most despicable, corrupt, immoral, good friend of our friend Barack, sleazy scum of the earth.
Okay.
How shall I put this?
Can you be more specific?
Yeah, I can be more specific.
No, seriously, what have they done?
What have they done? Them and their buddy Barack Obama have single-handedly brought this financial catastrophe on our country through their dealings with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Barack Obama is the second most highest person from Acorn who registers dead people and buses homeless people from state to state. Where do I stop?
Oh, yeah. There is your average crowd at your McCain, and myself to the point I can't say their names properly, at the McCain-Palin rallies. Those are the people that you run into. And I don't know what to say other than, wow. Are McCain and Palin racist? Of course they are. They're now, you know, their campaign people are coming on saying, well, they can't be responsible for an occasional crazy in the mob. You know, they're not responsible for that. They are responsible for this ugliness with inflammatory speeches. But the one thing we all have to remember is that extremism has been in the political arena. This is nothing new for the Republicans. Do remember that. It was Barry Goldwater who said, extremity is no vice. That was one of his mantras. And not many people looked at him as extreme, but he was very much a moderate compared to today's Republicans, your average Republican. And in the study of psychology, you have a group of people who same political beliefs that they will ultimately become because they won't hear anything but their own beliefs and those around them that have the same beliefs. No matter what, if you're with somebody that believes 2 and 2 is 5, and everybody around you believes 2 and 2 is 5, and you all tort that back and forth from one to another, this group is convinced that 2 and 2 is 5. And so when you get people that have the same political beliefs, they're ultimately going to become extreme because they won't hear anything making them believe that they're right no matter what. And then, therefore, they become even more extreme. And we have to consider the fact that if you have a group that's extreme, there will be sort of a contest for leadership. And those that are seeking the leadership roles are kind of going to see it as an advantage to be just a little bit more extreme. And that, to themselves at least, and maybe to the others as well, makes themselves seem to be a better neocon than the rest. More devout and a little more extreme. You aren't just any radical neocon, you're the pack leader at that point. And it's not just Republicans who have this problem. The fringes on both sides are vulnerable to this sort of thing. The only thing is that so far in this campaign, the Democratic candidates have, to their great credit, have kept the loonies from coming out of the woodwork, and the Republicans have not. It's that simple. The Republicans, the McPalin-McCain campaign kind of behavior at their rallies, they have not put it down at all. Fortunately, we have no reports of anything like that Hama rally, but I can tell you this much, and you know this to be true. Standing in front of the stage and somebody yelled, kill him. You can bet Barack Obama would stop that person in their tracks and admonish them for saying such a horrible thing. What would happen? The Democratic candidates have calm and rational, while this gone out and preached hatred and divisiveness, and that's the difference. And I'm afraid some of this gets us to the point where we can't put the genie back in the bottle. I'm afraid that the hate that is being preached right now and the hate that you just heard from these lines of people waiting to get into the Palin-McCain rallies, that kind of hatred is dangerous for America. It's dangerous to our way of life. It is not. In fact, it is the antithesis of what these people say. Well, they're so American. They were singing God Bless America. How can you sit there and sing God Bless America when a little bit before someone yelled, kill him? How can you sing God Bless America and claim to be a patriot and wrap yourself in a flag when you're standing there saying the opposite side is a terrorist and a Muslim and all this and that is that they make? How can you do that? First of all, by the type of behavior, you're exposing your ignorance. And the average IQ, I'd hate to say what the average IQ people waiting to get into these McCain-Palin rallies really is. I'm sorry, but I've seen half a dozen videos now taken to lines. And I have to tell you, I'm not impressed. Not impressed at all. And then you've got Dennis that, oh, they're saying bad things about me at the Obama rallies, too. First of all, has he been to an Obama rally? I can tell you this. I have not seen him at an Obama or a Biden rally. Have you? If you have, let me know. And if you have proof of it, let me know. But I have not. And I had the pain of, had to endure the pain of watching a little bit of Hannity yesterday, or listening a little bit of Hannity, because I was on the lookout for something I knew he was going to say. More of a hate monger anywhere than this little clown Hannity? Is there a worse one than him? About this, I've gotten so that if anyone says to me that they're a fan of Sean Hannity, that they listen to him and like his beliefs and his thoughts, I just tell them I can't talk to you. I won't talk to you. You are not worth a moment of my time. And I have done so. I have done that. And it's not even rude. It's not rude at all. If someone stands and tells me they're a fan of Sean Hannity and they believe his crazy, radical beliefs, his absolutely hate-filled speech that he comes across with every day, And at least Limbaugh is more of an entertainer. Hannity lives and breathes the hatred, and you can hear it. You can hear the hatred in his voice, and he's done everything he can as possible. So, I'm not kidding. When someone tells me that they're a Hannity, Sean, I have the greatest contempt. It's not one of these things where I say, well, we've got to agree to disagree, it's drawn. We can agree to different things, but we cannot agree to disagree like Sean Hannity. I have tried to get a response from him. I have tried to get a word from his people, from him, anything about his yelling fiercely what he's doing. And, of course, from any of them, ever. He is, I very much regret when I was at the Democratic National Convention and being sold to him the entire time I was there during broadcast. I very much respect just not starting one with him out in the hall, not getting all... Didn't want to be disrespectful to the Democratic campaign, but I would like to have started a real... with the likes of Sean Hannity. You know he can't stand in his views only with his radical, crazy, neocon hate speech. But I guess I talk too much about him. But it's an ugly thing. Very ugly thing. And I think these people have fostered hatred. A couple of interesting things. First of all, in the interest of fairness... And I hope that I am nothing if not fair on this program. I do try and always point out the good things and bad things about both sides. Tim Mahoney, Democratic congressman, took the place of a disgraced Republican here in Florida. Had all these ads about what a great family man I am and all that. Now we find that he's made a $121,000 payment to a former mistress who worked on his staff and was threatened to sue him. Former members of his staff who've been briefed on the settlement, which in campaign committee, poor Bob Graham, elected. $100, Mahoney made this payoff. Why didn't he just come out and Mahoney was going to get exposed anyway? That's the problem. Once again, I talk them and feel the need to report on this. This is not accepted. Mahoney needs to go. He needs to go right now. When his predecessor was in, at least he had the good sense to get out. Mark Foley, I'm talking about. He had the good sense to get out. They pretty much forced him out. The Republicans did. They went and told him to his face, we will not back you anymore. We would just as soon you get the hell out of the Congress of the United States. And he did. Give him credit for that. They tried to cover it up a bit first, and then finally when the truth was going to come out, that was it. And I'm not just saying this because the Democrats will have a huge majority in the House with or without Mahoney. There is no room for payoffs going on of $121,000. It was over. And hush money. There's no room for that in this country's leader. And while I'm at it, Nancy Pelosi should get on the Capitol steps and say that William Jefferson isn't worthy of Democrats. Make examples of these people. That's what should be done. Make examples of them. Have no sympathy for them. Speaking of having no sympathy, McCain is going to bring up the William Ayers affair. He has told many people to bring it up tomorrow night at the debate. I welcome that. I think the idea that Obama will stand there and tell you the truth about what happened, what his involvement is, I think he will absolutely convince the American people there was nothing untoward on his part whatsoever. And I love the line that John McCain has been using over and over and over again. And it goes something like this, paraphrasing, I don't need any advice on honesty and ethics and morals, and if I ever did, I wouldn't ask a Democratic politician from Chicago for it. Well, maybe you just ought to ask, John. Because I'm convinced, and time will tell, but I'm convinced that the little note I'm about to read you was written by one Barack Obama. In 1986, John McCain wrote a political note, and I know this is, I know it, but it still speaks to the character of this. In 1986, John McCain wrote a political note on official House ordinary, apologizing to Charles, having listed his good friend and supporter, of McCain's Senate Campaign Finance Committee. A note addressed to Senator months before McCain won his seat, telling and Keating says, don't be silly. You can call me anything, write anything, or do anything. I'm yours till death do us part. Well, isn't that just precious? Find me a note like that about John, about Barack Obama, Mr. McCain. And I will seriously listen to what you have to say tomorrow night, if you do, in fact, have the guts to bring up the William Ayers story. We're going to pause for a break right now, here on the Guy James Show, 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
But your room. What's more, they don't.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Really, really cold. Actually, Mom's handout are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
What about that one? Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200 years, and a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. It'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more still. Ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run without sis...
Do.
Show. Thank you for being with us this afternoon. Always good to know all of you along with us. I see we've got a good audience this afternoon. That pleases me. Thank you. 866-546-5254. I see Rick Sanchez on CNN. Someone sent me an email that the McCain campaign is livid with CNN for exposing Palin's relationship with the AIP, the Alaskan Independent Party, and they showed the video of Sarah addressing the group's last convention. What, they just now getting around to that? What, we talked about that, what, 3 days after Sarah Palin was nominated? The McCain people say furthering the smear? Well, I can't get over that. That is news at this time. It has been it has been out there for some time. We certainly immediately played you the audio of Sarah Palin congratulating the AI about the good work and all that. I don't see where this all of a sudden is news. I guarantee 4 days after she was named. So, I don't know. First of all, I don't know why CNN is doing it now, unless it is to incite the campaign to come on over and answer some questions about it. That would be a good thing. And really, I'm finding it surprising that the McCain campaign is just now catching on to this. We know that the chairman of the AIP had talked about the first dude being a member of the AIP for quite a while. We know herself had been very supportive of them. At first, it had been reported that she had been a member of the AIP. We do know where that her husband was, and we do also know from her very words that she's been very supportive of the AIP. And as you all know, the Alaskan Independent Party is a group started by this radical, can't think of his name right offhand, but who called for the secession of Alaska from the United States of America. Remember America First? You remember that? America First? Well, yeah, the America First. Her husband was a diehard member who always wishes them well and talks to their convention each year that she's been well. This is a group who wants to secede from the United States of America. Yeah. Those are the kind of organizations. And when we talk about the state of Alaska, and Alaska is no more than a microcosm of the rest of the country. They've got a lot of places up in Idaho and, you know what I'm talking about, groups that, sympathetic with the AIP, the kind of goings on that the AIP, endorses. So, for the campaign right now, Palin McCain campaign to be upset about this now, hell, this is common knowledge. Very common knowledge. Well, it's common knowledge to you and I. Yes, I will say that the American public has not been exposed to it all that much. Maybe that's what CNN is up to. Very few people know this story. And sometimes I delude myself by saying, well, hell, everybody knows about this. Well, you know it because you keep up with things. My audience knows it. People here on the horn know it because we bring up these things. In fact, many times, we find that we are reporting things like that. We're right there at the beginning of it and some on a day or two later. And you will find if you listen to Bob, listen to Mark, listen to my show, you listen to those on a regular basis, you won't hear what we're talking about on the mainstream media, on MSNBC or CEC or CNN or those until 2 or 3 days later. I'm telling you, that's how it is. And, you know, the story has come up this past about the same contractor involved in building that big albatross weight around the city of Wasilla's neck, a huge skating rink that she decided they had to have up there that's losing money hand over fist. Seems some of the people that supplied the building supplies for that also did supply the building supplies for her house, her $550,000 house that's on a lake. So, we don't know, we do know that Todd Palin said that he and some of his buddies built that house. Just a lot of interesting things that went on with that whole story, you know. Sarah Palin got building permits eliminated in Wasilla. That's a wide open town, Wasilla. I've been there years ago. It was much smaller than it is now. It was pretty much just on the road. Can't remember if they had one or two stoplights. But they did away with building permits. There's no record about who did the actual building, what contractor, and that. They do have completion permits there. Once the house is completed, they have to report that. So there's all this mystery surrounding her house. a lot of mysteries surrounding her house. Did Todd build that house? Also, of course, we know that supplied the building materials for the skating rink and her house, Palin's racing, his snowmobile machine racing up there. Is a snow machine different than a snowmobile? He sponsored Todd Palin's racing, this supplier did, and will not come out unequivocally and say that his people had no hand in building that house. He's just saying, well, gee, I really don't know. I don't know. Where there's smoke, there's usually some fire, and of course, the same builder, I might add, the same building supply person, supplied the building supplies for the Ted Stevens house. This is getting interesting, isn't it? So, the McCain, I apologize. The McCain-Palin campaign appears to have a problem. Of course, even if we found out that some built that house for them gratis and gave it to them and violated every law in the book, they would still stand denied any culpability in this problem the other day about the trooper. I didn't do anything more legally or ethically. Although it says quite plain and simply in the report. So we'll end up being anything. Will it end up being a big kickback story if it'll end anything at all? Who knows? But as it comes out, we weren't first on that story, but we have been first on some other ones. 652-54. Did you hear about Rush Limbaugh, Mr. OxyContin himself, the drug-addled right-wing talk show host, Limbaugh, Mr. Truthful, Rush Limbaugh? I wonder, I've never had any OxyContin. Have you? Does it really scramble your head that much? If it is a painkiller, from what I understand? And he was supposedly was taking it because he had a bad back or something or other, and it turns out he was taking like a handful of them in a day's time or whatever, and it's supposed to be like one every 8 hours from what I know, OxyContin. We know what he sounds like on OxyContin because there is no question, and I've mentioned to you this before, his criminal activity with the illegal drugs was exposed, I think most everybody that listened to there was something seriously wrong with him, his slurring of his speech and all that he'd lost his that up and all. So we know what Rush, and do you know, I didn't know this until not long ago. He has those cochlear ear implants in his skull to help him hear, but he still can't hear. He's still, for all intents and purposes, legally deaf. Didn't know that. So it's meaningless to have a conversation at a dinner table because he can't really hear you. But anyway, what I want to go on, he got in this little Mary Mitchell, a columnist for the Chicago Sun. And so Limbaugh yesterday, well, let me back up. Let me set this up for you. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Mary Mitchell called out Sarah Palin for inciting hatred at her rally, just like we've been talking about earlier in the program, and she got quite an angry response from Rush Limbaugh yesterday. And quoting Limbaugh here, he says, Mary Mitchell, a wuss, a wimp columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, isn't that something? Rush Limbaugh calling somebody a wuss and a wimp. Pot calling. All right. Says that Sarah Palin should be censured. She says that Sarah Palin should apologize to the Obama campaign and the American people for her role in bringing out the worst in her supporters. This is laughable, says Rush. Come on, Mary, grow up. This is the big leagues. How about the people in your party? I know you're a Democrat, Mary Mitchell. All you liberal media people are Democrats. About the incitement of this whole country that you and your fellow journalists have been along with the Democrat Party. You have gendered up hate for this president, a despise for the U.S. military. You have sought to convince American people their country is worthless and sinking into the abyss. Cheers. Limbaugh also called Mitchell a racist nut. So, I don't think old Rushy boy... I don't think Rush knew that Mary Mitchell is not about to wimp out, not about to cave in to anything. And so she responded to him, and I love her response. She said, when you step on a pig's tail, it squeals. Rush Limbaugh is a squealer. And why is he squealing? Because John McCain and Sarah Palin are losing ground in a contest that they thought was theirs. And they're losing it to a black man. Of course, Limbaugh won't say that. Instead, on Thursday, he spent his time berating me for saying Palin needs to apologize for inciting crowds that hurled racial epithets at black members of the press. I'm a wuss, a wimp columnist, Limbaugh says, she says. So why would a multi-million dollar squealer use his on-air time on a wuss and a wimp? The reason Limbaugh is squealing like a pig, the pig he is because he's the epitome of white privilege. He can't wrap his small mind around the fact that Barack ain't butt in the polls. And to make matters worse, how a black woman ask a white woman who's on the GOP ticket the inappropriate behavior of her supporters? But my position is a no-brainer, Mitchell says. Whenever a crowd gets whipped up to the point that they turn ugly, start hurling racist insult. It is common sense that in, but McCain is so desperate to win, he's just angry crowds. Come on. The squealer, meaning the man that Barack Obama, the pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, for comments deemed, I repeat, had Obama fans acted a fool, McCain fan did, every pundit, with the squealer leading the way, would have demanded he offer some kind of apology. So Mitchell says, I'm the racist nutball, but the squealer is the one who made a fortune ridiculing black people at every opportunity. But I have a voice too. And all of Limbaugh's bluster and all the calls of his rabid followers won't be enough to silence me when bigoted bullies are running amok. And besides, I'm not running for vice president. Limbaugh's sorry-ass Palin is. If Limbaugh wants to spend his time trying to bully me, as they say in my neighborhood, bring it. This from Mary Mitchell, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. And Mary, bully for you. Limbaugh should have known. She's a feisty gal. Market right now is down 60 points, something like that. It has been down as much as 250. It has been up as much as, I think, over 250 or 60. Another odd day on Wall Street. The bulls were running wild yesterday, and they had to take... Plan out the hour, we're probably going to discuss the electoral map as it sits right now. I enjoy looking at the electoral map right now. Beauty. And we'll go over that when we come back. If you 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254, we'd like to welcome Elo back to the chat room. By the way, all of you listening at another venue, be sure and head on over to the Head On Radio Network chat room. All you got to do is sign in. Just takes a moment or so. You don't have to give a credit card number or personal information or anything. I just give you a password to get in there, and you need to do that. Join this crowd. We got quite a crowd on there today. And I like to think, I don't like to think, I know that this group in the chat room right now, they're very, very educated people in the political scene. They know very well what's going on in the political scene. 866-546-5254. And I agree with Bedtime for Bonzo. He said, ignore the market. It makes as much sense as ice when you lift a hay bale. Some run up, others run down. We'll talk a little bit about the market when we come back. It's nothing more than a Las Vegas. Well, the regular people who gamblers and the bankers and the Wall Street are the house, and you know how that works. And that's exactly how that they have a built-in advantage. We're going to stop for news coming up at the Guy James Show here in the Head On Radio Network, so don't go away. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers gave GOP vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin the reception she deserved in Pittsburgh. Jesse Russell has the story.
The United Steelworkers joined with several other unions in downtown Pittsburgh today to drive home the message that vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin doesn't represent union if her husband Todd is a card-carrying union member. The VPIC has used her husband's steelworker membership to try and win over blue-collar workers that may be less inclined to vote for a Republican. Palin was in Pittsburgh a fundraiser, and the steelworkers said they led the march to the Weston Convention Center so she could meet the union that represents her.
Around the country, bragging to workers about their great union benefits. They didn't even have the time to come over and say hello to all the people that work hard for them every day. So we're going to go to them.
The march that was estimated to number between 200 and 400 was also used to point out that Palin has spent very little time, if any, speaking about issues important to working families, such as family leave and child care. They also wanted to remind voters that her running mate, Senator John McCain, seeks to privatize Social Security, would sign trade deals that would export jobs, and wants to tax employer-provided health care.
International Association of Machinists President Tom Buffenbarger is willing to join the talks to end the Boeing strike if he's needed. Talks began Sunday for the first time since the 27,000 union workers went on strike at Boeing. The strike has shut down Boeing aircraft production. The union says so far the strike has cost Boeing more than $3.7 billion, or roughly $100 in lost sales. Buffenbarger says the union is having a hard time. Issues include job security, retirement security. Economist Dean Baker says the U.S. will get through the financial crisis, but there's before things rebound.
My expectations, we will get through the crisis. There will be more bank failures, so that would be a lot of very bad news through that. Now, we're still going to have a very serious, we have to switch from a situation where we had a near zero situation where we have a normal savings rate somewhere around 8% of household income.
People begin to save more, they will consume less, and that will be a difficult. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shear.
Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Think he's practicing the politics of the past. John Mick's attacks on Barack Obama? Not true. False. Baloney. But John McCain. Same old politics. Same disease. Barack Obama supports a $1,000 middle class tax cut. An enemies, develops alternative fuels, and breaks the grip of four. That's change we can believe in.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, you hear me? It's my creation! Fly!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get caught up. Six. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We have to say, so, and so, my
your country can do for you. Ask what you can do your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for hearing the Guy James Show today and the Head On Radio Network. Lots going on, eh? We've got another debate, if you want to call them that, tomorrow evening. What do you think? Will John McCain have the cojones to bring up the William Ayers incident? Or story. It's not really an incident. It's a story. Will he have the gonads to go ahead and do that tomorrow, do you think? Now, he's promised several people that that he will. If he does, I say that's the end of him. Absolutely the end of him and his campaign if he does that. That will put the grave marker on top of his dead campaign if he does that tomorrow evening. There's no question in my mind. And so, therefore, I hope that he does. I really hope that he does. And speaking of the electoral process, we were going to talk about that a little earlier. It's looking very, very, very bleak for the McCain people right now. Just about as bad as it gets here. Let me... I had a couple of them I was looking at. Had in the McCain campaign at the moment. Looking at, well, what do you know? It won't come up right at it. Looking at this political mapping, they now have Indiana a lead for McCain. They now have Virginia and North Carolina with a lead for Obama. They have Florida with a lead for Obama, Michigan, Wisconsin, Missouri with an lead for Wisconsin, or for Missouri with a lead for Obama, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, and of course in the camp we have Iowa, we have Minnesota, Washington, Oregon, Maine, New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, Maryland, New York, Vermont, Illinois, California. It's got to be absolutely to the McCain people when they look at this and see North Carolina and being put in the Obama campaign column. That would make the electoral vote right now, if the election were held today, that would be 4 to 174. 64 to 174. And we still believe Indiana might be able to swing. Might be able to swing. Georgia is just leaning right now. Georgia, can you imagine? So we've got a very interesting story on hand here with this Electoral College map. Let me look at the other one that I look at just about every day as well over at electoralvote.com. They have Florida leaning down to a... they have West Virginia with a weak Democratic lead. I don't know about the lead... Indiana, barely GOP, Nevada. So, this one, total is on this one. This one has it, if it were today, 300 Obama, 181 McCain. And in the Senate races, if the election were held today, we have the Democrats and the GOP 41, and the House Democrats getting 247 and the GOP 186. So things are looking good at the moment. No question, things are looking good at the moment. It's going to be interesting to see if these leads hold up. Several of these swing states have gone back and forth. And they could again. But what we see right now, what we have in front of us right now, this looks extremely good for Barack Obama. Don't give up the fight. Stay on it. It's something you can't give up on ever, right down to the last day. But I don't think it's going to be all that close this time around. I really, really do not think it's going to be all that close. Some of you, in fact, last week, when we played Franklin Roosevelt's Fireside Chat about... I've got such a grist of that, and people ask for more, so I'm going to do that right now. I'm going to play a piece on Franklin Roosevelt on talking about Social Security and how people were trying to put it in danger even back then. Yes. So Franklin Roosevelt on Social Security, this is long, but it's interesting, and don't forget, it is by one of the great, for my money, in the history of the world. There is no doubt in my mind, none at all, that this country wouldn't even be close to where it is today. It's hard for me to imagine that it would even be the country that it is today without one Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
My friends, last Thursday I described in detail certain economic problems which everyone admits now face the nation. For the many messages which have come to me after that speech, and which it is physically impossible to answer individually, I take this means of saying thank you. Tonight, sitting at my desk in the White House, I make my first radio report to the people in my second term of office. I'm reminded of that evening in March, 4 years ago, when I made my first radio report to you. We were then in the midst of the great banking crisis. Soon after, with the authority, we asked the nation to turn over all of its privately held dollar for dollar to the government of the United States. Today shows how right that policy was. But when on 2 years later, it came before the Supreme Court, its conduct was upheld only by a 5-4 vote. The change of one vote would have thrown all the nation back into hopeless chaos. In effect, hold that the right under a private contract, a pound of flesh, was more sacred than the main object to establish an enduring nation. In 1933, you and I knew that we must never let our economic system get completely out of joint again, that we could not afford to take the risk of another Great Depression. We also became convinced that the only way to avoid a repetition of those dark days was to have a government with power to prevent and to cure the abuses and the inequalities which had thrown that system out of joint. We then began a program of remedying those abuses and inequalities to give balance and stability to our economic system, to make it bomb-proof against the causes of 1929. Today, we are only part way through that program, and recovery is speeding up to a point where the dangers of 1929 are again possible. Not this week or month, perhaps, but national laws are needed to complete that. Individual or local or state effort alone in 1937 any better than so. It will take time and plenty of time, remedies administratively, even after legislation passed, to complete our program of protection in time. We cannot delay one moment in making certain that our government has power to carry through. 4 years ago, not come until the 11th hour, it was almost too late. If we learned anything from the Depression, we will not allow ourselves to run around in new circles of futile discussion and debate, always postponing the day of decision. The American people have learned from the Depression, for in the last three national elections, an overwhelming majority of them voted a mandate that the Congress and the President begin the task of providing that protection, not after long years of debate, but now. The courts, however, have cast doubts on the ability of the elected Congress to protect us against catastrophe by meeting squarely our modern social and economic conditions. We are at a crisis for ability to proceed with that protection. A quiet crisis. There are no lines of depositors outside closed, but to the far-sighted, it is far-reaching in its possibilities of injury to America. I want to talk with you very simply tonight about the need for present action in this crisis, the need to meet the unanswered challenge of one-third of a nation ill-nourished, ill-clad, ill-housed. Last Thursday, I described the American form of government as a three-horse team provided by the Constitution to the American people so that their field might be plowed. The three horses are, of course, the three branches of government, the Congress, the executive, and the courts. Two of the horses, the Congress and the executive, today. The third is not. Those who have intimated that the President of the United States is team overlook the simple fact the President as chief executive is himself one of the... It is the American people themselves, the driver's seat. It is the American people themselves who want... It is the American people themselves who worked the third horse to pull in unison with the other two. I hope that you have reread the Constitution of the United States in these past few weeks. Like the Bible, it ought to be read again and again. It is an easy document to understand when you remember that it was called into being because the Articles of Confederation, under which the original 13 states tried to operate after the Revolution, showed the need of a national government with power enough to handle national problems. In its preamble, the Constitution states that it was intended to form a more perfect union and promote the general welfare. And the powers given to the Congress to carry out those purposes can best be described by saying that they were all the powers needed to meet each and every problem which then had a national character and not be met by merely local action. The Constitution went further, having in mind that in succeeding nations, many other problems then undreamed of would become national. They gave to the Congress the ample, broad power to levy taxes and provide for the common defense and welfare of the United States. That, my friends, what I honestly believe to have been the clear and underlying who wrote a federal constitution to create a national intended, as they said, perfect union for ourselves and our. For nearly 20 years, there was no conflict between the Congress and the court. Then in 1803, Congress passed a statute which the court said violated an express provision of the Constitution. The court claimed the power to declare it unconstitutional and did so declare it. But a little later, the court itself admitted that it was an extraordinary power to exercise, and through Mr. Justice Washington, laid down this limitation upon it. He said, "It is but a decent respect due to the wisdom, the integrity, and the patriotism of the legislative body by which any law is passed to presume in favor of its validity until its violation of the Constitution is proved beyond all reasonable doubt." But since the movement for social and economic progress through legislation more often and more boldly power to veto laws passed by the Congress and by state. Great disregard of this original which I have just read. In the last 4 years, giving statutes the benefit of all reasonable doubt been cast aside. The court has been acting judicial body, but as a policy-making body. When the Congress has sought to stabilize national agriculture, to improve the conditions of labor, to safeguard business against unfair competition, to protect our national resources, and in many to serve our clearly national needs, the majority of the power to pass on the wisdom of the Congress and to approve or disapprove the public into these laws. That is not only accusation. It is the accusation of most distinguished present Supreme Court. I have not the time to you all the language used by dissenting justices in many of these cases. In the case holding the Railroad Retirement Act constitutional, for instance, Chief Justice Hughes said in a that the majority opinion was a departure from sound for an unwarranted limitation upon the Commerce Clause, and three other justices agreed with him. In the case holding the AAA unconstitutional, Justice Stone said of the majority opinion that it was a tortured construction of the Constitution, and two other justices agreed with him. In the case holding the New York minimum wage law unconstitutional, Justice Stone said that the majority were actually reading into the Constitution their own personal economic predilections, and that if the legislative power is not left free to choose the methods of solving the problems of poverty, subsistence, and health of large numbers in the community, then government is to be rendered impotent, and two others with him. In the face of these dissenting opinions, there is no basis for the claim made by some members of something in the Constitution has compelled them to regret the will of the people. In the face of such, it is perfectly clear that, as Chief Justice Hughes has said, we are under a Constitution, but the Constitution is what the judges say it is. The court, in addition to the proper use of its judicial functions, has improperly set itself up as a third house of the Congress, a super legislature, as one of the justices has called it, reading into the Constitution words and implications which are not there and were never intended to be there. The point as a nation where we must take action to save the Constitution from the court and the court from itself. We must find a way to take an appeal from the court to the Constitution itself. We want it which will do justice under the Constitution over it. In our courts, we want a government of and not of men. I want an independent judiciary as proposed in the Constitution. That means a Supreme Court as written that will refuse to amend the Constitution by the arbitrary exercise of judicial power. In other words, by judicial say-so. It does not mean a judiciary so independent that since the facts which are universally recognized. How then could we proceed to perform the mandate given us? It was said in last year's Democratic platform, and here are the words, if these problems cannot be effectively solved within the Constitution, we shall seek such clarifying amendments as will assure the power to enact those laws adequately to regulate commerce, protect public health and safety, and safeguard economic security. In other words, we said we would seek an amendment only if every other possible means by legislation were to fail. when I commenced to review the situation with the problem squarely before me, I came by a process of elimination. The only method which was plausible and would at the same time carry out other was to infuse new blood into all force. We must have men worthy and equipped of justice, but at the same time, judges who will bring to the courts a present-day sense, judges who will retain in the courts judicial functions of a court and reject the lid which the courts have today assumed. It is well for us to remember that in 45 out of the 48 states of the Union, judges are chosen not for life, but for a period of years. In many states, judges must retire at the age of 70. Congress has provided financial security by offering life pensions at full pay for federal judges on all courts retire at 70. In the case of justices, that pension is $20,000, but all federal judges can, if they choose, hold office for life old they may get to be. What is my proposal? It is simply this. If any federal court has reached the age of 70, avail himself of the opportunity to retire on a pension, a new member resident then in office, with the approval, as required by the Constitution, of the Senate of the United States. That plan has two chief purposes. By bringing into the judicial system a steady and continuing stream of new and younger blood, I hope first to make the administration of all federal justice from the bottom to the top speedier and therefore less costly. Secondly, to bring to the decision of social and economic problems younger men who have had personal experience and contact with modern facts and circumstances under which average men have to live and work. This plan will save our national constitution from hardening of the judicial art. The number of judges to be appointed depend wholly on the decision of present judges now over 70 who would subsequently reach the age of 70. If, for instance, any one of the six justices of the Supreme Court at the age of 70 should retire as per the plan, no additional place would be created. Although there never can be more than 15, there may be only 14 or 13 or 12. Be only 9. There is nothing more radical about this idea. It seeks to maintain the federal bench in force. It has been discussed and approved by many persons of higher authority ever since a similar proposal passed the House of Representatives in 1869. Why was the age fixed at 70? Because the laws of many states and the practice of the civil service, the regulations of the Army and Navy, and the rules of many of our universities and of almost every great private business enterprise commonly fix the retirement age at 70 years or less. The statute would apply to all the courts in the federal system. There is general approval so far as the lower federal courts are concerned. The plan has met opposition only so far as the Supreme Court of the United States itself is concerned. But my plan is good for the lower courts. It's certainly equally good for the highest court, from which there is no appeal. Those opposing this plan have sought to cause prejudice and fear by crying that I am seeking the Supreme Court and that a baneful precedent will be established. What do they mean by the words in court? Let me answer this question that will end all honest ending of my purposes. If by that phrase it is charged that I wish to place on the bench spineless puppets who would disregard the law and would decide specific cases as I wish them to be decided, I make this answer, that no president fit for his office would appoint, and no Senate of honorable men fit for their office would confirm that kind of appointees to the Supreme Court. But if by that phrase the charge is made that I would appoint and the Senate would confirm justices worthy to sit beside present members of the court who understand modern conditions, that I will appoint justices who will not undertake to override the judgment of the Congress on legislative policy, that I will appoint justices who will act as justices and not as legislators, if the appointment of such justices is packing the court, then I say that I, the vast majority of the American people, favor us that thing now. There's precedent for the Congress to change the number of the justices. The Congress has always had and will have. The number of justices has been changed several times before in the administration of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, born of independence. In the administrations of Andrew Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, I suggest justices to the bench in accordance with a clearly defined principle relating to a clearly defined age limit. Fundamentally, if in the future America cannot trust the Congress it elects to refrain from abuse of our constitutional usages, democracy will have failed far beyond the importance to democracy of any kind of precedent concerning the judiciary. We think it so much in the public interest to maintain a vigorous judiciary that we encourage the retirement of elderly judges by offering them a life pension at full salary. Why then should we leave the fulfillment of this public policy to chance, or make it dependent upon the desire or prejudice of any individual justice? Their intention of our public policy to provide for a new and younger blood into the judiciary. Normally, every number of district and circuit judges and a few member court. Until my first term, practically every in our history had appointed at least one member court. President Taft appointed 5 members, and President Wilson, 3. President Harding, including a Chief Justice. President Coolidge, 1, including a Chief Justice. A succession of appointments should have provided a court well-balanced, but chance and the disinclination of individuals to leave the Supreme Bench have now given us a court in which 5 justices will be over 75 years of age before next June, and 1 over 70. Thus, a sound public policy has been defeated. So I now propose that we establish by law an assurance against any such ill-balanced court in the future. I propose that hereafter, when a judge reaches the age of 70, a new and younger judge shall be added to the court automatically. In this way, I propose to enforce a sound public policy by law. Instead of leaving the composition of our federal courts, including the highest, to be determined by personal decision of individuals, it, as I propose, is regarded as establishing a new precedent, is errable. Precedent. Like all laws, like all Americans, I regret the necessity of this but the welfare of the United States, and indeed of the Constitution itself, is what we all must think about first. With the court today, rises not from the court as an institution, but from human beings within it. Our constitutional destiny to the personal judge being fearful of the future would deny us the necessary means of dealing with the present. This plan of mine is no attack on the court. It seeks to restore the court to its rightful and historic place in our system of constitutional government and to have it resume its high task of building anew on the Constitution a system of living law. The court itself can best undo what the court has done. I have thus explained to you the reasons that lie behind our efforts to secure results by legislation within the Constitution. I hope that thereby the difficult process of constitutional amendment may be rendered unnecessary. But let us examine that process. There are many proposed. Each one is radically different. No substantial group within the Congress were agreed on any single. Believe that it would take months or years until agreement upon the type and language of an amendment. Years thereafter, to get a 2/3 in favor of that amendment in both houses of the Congress. On the long course of ratification by thrones of all the states, no amendment which any power or the leaders of any powerful political party have had reason to oppose has ever been ratified within anything like a reasonable time. And remember that 13 states which contain only 5% of the voting population can block ratification, even though the 35 states with 95% of the population are in favor of it. A very large percentage of newspaper publishers and chambers of commerce and bar associations and manufacturers associations who are trying to give the impression today that they really do want a constitutional amendment would be the very first to exclaim as soon as an amendment was proposed, "Oh, I was for an amendment, all right. But this amendment is not the kind of an amendment that I was thinking of." And so I am going to spend my time, my efforts, and my amendment, although I would be awfully glad to help some other kind of an amendment ratified. And on the ground that they favor a constitutional amendment, this includes those who fundamentally object to social and economic legislation. This is the same group who during campaign tried to block the mandate of the people. And the stand is to suggest the time-consuming process of amendment in order to kill off by delay the legislation demanded by the mandate. To those people I say, I do not think you will be able long to fool the American people as to your purposes. The other group is composed of those who honestly believe the amendment process is the best, and who would be willing to support a reasonable amendment if they could agree on one. To them I say, we cannot rely on an amendment as the immediate or only answer to our present difficulties. When the time comes for action, you will find that many of those who pretend to support you will sabotage any constructive amendment which is proposed. Look at these strange bedfellows of yours. When before have you found them really at your service for progress? And remember one more. Even if an amendment were passed, and even if in the years to come, its meaning would depend upon the kind of justices who would be sitting on the Supreme Court bench. For an amendment to the Constitution is what the justices say it is, rather than what its framers or you might hope it is. A proposal of mine will not infringe in the slightest upon the so dear to every American record as governor and as president proves my devotion.
Gentle breezes blow. wants to be famous. While there's still time, my one last wish. Someday you'll see how hard I try and how much you meant to me. Part of something, leave something good behind. Curtain falls, I take my bow. That's how it's meant to be. It's your world now. It's your world now. It's your world now.
Ah, yes, it's your world now, and seems to me that's kind of what we're up to right now, isn't it? Trying to make sure that this country is ours and that it stays ours and not fall into the hands of a few. It should be the country of the people, by the people, and for the people instead of a few. What this election is all about this time, more so now than perhaps ever before, when our freedoms, our liberties, financial well-being, our security, all of that, all things that are important to the American people. I cannot think of a time that's been more important in history now. That's why this election is so about this election. I'm feeling really good, but we cannot let up confidence, despite my confidence. I don't know how confident you are, but I'm starting to get confidence in a victory coming up, and I feel that way as well. We still got to keep, as they used to say, the pedal to the metal. And I think one thing that we can expect probably on November the 5th, when it is announced that, and I hope it's announced that we don't have any hanky-panky going on that causes another gruesome time like we had in 2000. But when it is finally admitted and conceded by the McCain-Palin campaign that indeed Barack Obama is the new president of the United States on November the 5th, I hope that America, all of America, will have the good sense to tone it down, to lick their wounds, their political wounds, get over it, and for a change, get behind a new president that gives this country some hope. Frankly, I do feel very hopeful. And I know we're in a real, real tough time right now. A very, very tough time. And many people are suffering. Health. Many people are suffering. But I am hopeful that a new administration can bring answers to the problems we now have and get this country back. This is, after all, America. And despite all the troubles we have, I believe that we can get back to what we should be. It could be. And resume the direction that the Democratic been upward for so many years, and then we run into this ugly thing that we've got now, this ugly situation. So I hope I earnestly hope that. I sure do. 866-546-5254 program today, kind of a laid-back show today. I've gotten a lot of email, one in particular from a guy, some Republican, I'm assuming, that said he didn't care to hear anything more from me about the economy because I didn't want to ask from a hole in the ground, and that I gave opinions on it. Well, I am allowed to give my opinions on it, you see. Not only did I give a lot of facts about it, yes, I gave my opinions on it, and yes, I do know something about the economy, and yes, I do know enough for me anyway about economics and how this country works economically. So if you're offended by hearing some opinion, why, turn the thing off, okay? That's all. Anyway, we had a long discussion with somebody by email about derivatives, and a lot of people really don't understand derivatives. And, of course, derivatives are probably the number one reason that things have gone south economically, and probably the number one reason for all the financial institutions around the world. It's my opinion that what really caused this was the derivatives. And the best way to explain it is, and it's fairly difficult, but you can boil it down. Suppose you've got a neighbor whose house is worth $500,000, let's say, and that he's got a $400,000 mortgage held by the bank. Nothing unusual about that. He doesn't owe you any money, and you're no more than just neighbors and acquaintances. So I sell you a piece of paper for $5,000 that says, I will pay you the value of your next-door neighbor's house if he defaults on his mortgage. So really what you've bought for your $5,000 is a derivative. That's what derivatives are. And if he defaults, you really don't. And what do you lose if he and what do you gain by him not defaulting? So who gains by this silly ass derivative? I gained the $5,000 by selling it. All it cost me was a few dollars to have a lawyer draw it up and create it. And you gain because you now have a secured obligation. That's what it's called. And it'll value your neighbor's house, which you do not own, and upon which you do not now and never claim. But the face value of this secured debt obligation is $500,000. So you can show it to a banker, and this is exactly what's been going on all along. You can show it to a banker and borrow cash using this piece of paper as collateral. And the bank now has what it considers to be a secured loan for however much they loaned you on this thing. So now we've got the $400,000 mortgage, the $500,000 derivative, and a bank loan, all of it secured by this one $500,000 house. And when you add that all up, that's more than two times the value of the house, and it's riding on the homeowner paying the mortgage. And I've only sold one derivative against it. There's no limit on the number of derivatives I can sell against it. Is why the derivatives market is estimated to be over $50 trillion, and every penny, all of it. Derivatives are very simply financial instruments created for the sole money selling the instruments to people who are stupid enough to buy them.